This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with retired Senior Master Sergeant Larry Brooks. Today is October 13, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Brooks is joining me by phone from Las Vegas. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin, if we could, with a little bit of biographical information. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Sioux City, Iowa, on the 25th of February, 1948.
Okay. All right. Did you grow up there in Sioux City?
Actually, the hospital is on the Iowa side, and I was raised in a town called South Sioux City, Nebraska, right across the river.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My father was Alfred Francis Brooks, who was born in 1900 in Decatur, Nebraska. And he worked most of his life at the Armour's packing plant in Sioux City, Iowa. He was worked in a beef kill. And my mother was Marie Irene. Her maiden name was Carr. K-A-R-R-E-R,
okay.
And she was born in Iowa in 1904, and she owned her own business in a small town of South Sioux. She owned a baby store, and then I was adopted, and when they adopted me in 48, then she gave up the store and became a housewife for the remaining years of her life.
Okay, sir. All right. Well, what did you do for fun as a kid? Did you have any jobs or anything like that growing up?
I did. Of course, I think it's, a lot of kids start out in business. I was a newspaper carrier for the Sioux City Journal,
mm-hmm.
and my early teen years. And then I worked in the motion picture theaters. I started out at the State Theater in South Sioux. And I helped run the projectors and then clean the theater. That was really my first job. And then I got hired in the summertime for the drive-in theater in Sioux City. It was called the 75 Drive-In Theater. And they also operated the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City, Iowa. So when the drive-in closed, then I was transferred down to the Orpheum Theater and then also worked at a Hollywood Theater, which they also I believe they owned that one, at least that, and worked at both those. I worked as a usher and a doorman and a ticket taker, and you name it, I did about everything.
All right. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, as a kid growing up there in Nebraska, did you have any interest in the military as a kid? Had you had any relatives that had served in World War One, World War Two?
Yes. Give a little background on my father. My
okay.
father was very, very patriotic. He went down to enlist in World War One at the age of 17, and they wouldn't let him. He had to have his mother's permission. And then by the time he turned 18, the war was basically over.
Mm-hmm.
So he did not serve in World War One, which he wanted to serve in. In World War Two, he was 40 years of age and did not want to serve. And he actually worked at Armour's, and that was one of those businesses that they needed people, you know, to stay at their jobs.
Right.
So he stayed home. But his brother, my uncle, served in the Navy in World War II overseas.
Okay.
And his older brother had served in the Army in World War I and I believe World War II, and is actually buried in San Diego at the military Fort Rosecrans.
Okay.
And so the family had a military background. But I'll be honest with you, I never really thought about being in the military. Although when I attended my first year at the University of Nebraska, I joined Air Force ROTC and was and attended classes with that. But I didn't have, I guess what you want to call a strong emphasis in my youth to join the military.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. Okay. Where did you go to school?
I went to school my entire youthful career in the South Sioux City School District, and I graduated from South Sioux City High School in 1966.
1966, okay.
And then in 66 and 67, I went to the University of Nebraska, as a business major and flunked out horribly. I guess that's the best way to explain it.
Right. So, all right. Well, again, as a kid growing up, did you pay much attention to what was going on in the world with the Cold War and U.S. foreign policy, that type of thing?
I guess I was. My mother was fairly political, and so, you know, I always kept abreast of the news, and, you know, what was going on in Far East Asia and those type things. But the one thing I remember is when I was in my fraternity house down in Lincoln, we used to go down every night at, I think, 5:30 to watch Walter Cronkite on TV and get the updates on the war,
right.
Which I thought was kind of funny at the time. Not hilarious to me, but I guess weird. But I did watch it quite a bit that way.
Right, sir. Had you developed any sort of opinion on the war early on, watching it on TV?
Not really. You know, until I guess you enter the service, you just don't really think a whole lot about it. I was kept abreast of the things that were going on over there from, I want to say, probably the Kennedy administration on, but never believed that I would ever be over there fighting in it.
Well, Ed, did you know anyone from your high school, prior to you going, anyone from your high school or town that had served? Did you know anyone that had been to Vietnam?
Not really. I had known some individuals that I had worked with in South Sioux that had served in the military, but I had never... we actually had a couple kids killed from my hometown, but that was later on. And I really didn't know anybody that was in the military that much as far as that goes. It's your typical, I guess, Midwestern city where you're away from the military as far as that goes.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. And I know you you mentioned following a little bit of the developments with the Kennedy administration, what was going on over there. What about the Kennedy assassination? Could you talk a little bit about your recollections of that and your memories?
I'll never forget that day. I lived about a half a block from the high school, and I would usually go home over lunch.
Okay.
And I left the building, left the school, and walked off the rear entrance and went home, and my mother said, the president's just been shot. And it shocked me so much, I ran back over to the high school, and they were still serving lunch, and my science teacher was there, which was my next class after lunch. And I told him, and he grabbed the principal, and I was kind of known as a jokester in high school,
mm-hmm.
and I did not get along with the principal at all. And the principal thought I was lying, stirring up a story. And of course, I never had lunch that day, never ate. We went to class, and the science teacher came up and had said that the president is dead. And I remember the girls crying. I guess that's the biggest thing. So it's a day that will be enamored in my life for the rest of my life anyway. So.
Yes, sir. Right. All right. You said you graduated 1966?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. And Nebraska, you said you majored in business there at Nebraska?
My first turn at the university, okay. Was good, declared a business major because I'd worked at the theater and I knew how businesses operated, and I thought it would be a good major for me as far as that goes.
Right. All right.
It wasn't.
Right. Okay. Tell me about the Air Force ROTC program. Was that mandatory or voluntary?
It was a volunteer program, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, the people that we had come in and speak to us and, you know, talk about the military, I was very impressed. I was impressed with the professionalism of the officers. I guess maybe that's the biggest thing. Most of them, of course, were World War II veterans, and I was impressed with the program overall. When I came back, I should have joined the Air Force. I didn't. That's another story.
All right. All right. Okay. Let's see. So you were there for 2 years, and then...
Just 1 year. Part of 66 okay. and part of 67. Okay. Just my first year, my freshman year.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. All right. Once you decided at that time that college just wouldn't work out for you, what did you do at that point?
Actually, I came back to South Sioux, and I actually worked two jobs. I worked at a furniture store during the daytime and then the theater at night. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I was waiting to get drafted. You know, when you're young and you want to party all the time and...
Right.
It's just a different type of life. So I really don't, you know, have anything that I physically wanted to do. I guess I wanted to get through my life. I guess maybe that's the best way to explain it.
Sure. Yes, sir. Did you realize, though, that that getting drafted was a decent possibility? It was a realistic possibility, being in college?
Yes, by far. I knew it would... probably happen. I didn't want it to happen, but I knew it probably would happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, when did you receive your draft notice?
I received my draft notice in March of 1968.
Okay.
And I was drafted on the 23rd of March, 1968.
Okay. Yes, sir. And prior to that, had you paid attention to what was going on in television with the Tet Offensive? Were you aware of the developments that were going on?
I was aware of it. I didn't follow it too well because, again, I was working two jobs, so I didn't have a lot of time. My late 60s, I didn't see a whole lot of TV, I guess is the best way to explain it. Just mainly what I read once in a while in the papers. But okay. I was so busy with work and trying to earn money that I wasn't... I was aware of the Tet Offensive. I just wasn't deeply involved in reading about it.
All right. Okay. Well, once you received that draft notice, what was your reaction to it?
Shock. I don't know how to explain it any other way. I had had, as a child, I had some ulcer problems, and I thought maybe that might keep me out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have the worst flat feet you ever saw in your life, but
right.
But that didn't keep me out either. So I guess I didn't, how do you want to say this? Again, my father was so patriotic, and it instilled about doing the right thing that I guess I wouldn't say worried about it. I guess I was apprehensive, but I wasn't worried about it. I mean, I figured it would work out in the end. I didn't have as a late teenager, I didn't have a lot of direction in my life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I was going, that type of thing.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, what was your family's reaction to you being drafted?
My mother actually called the Orpheum Theater and got me on the phone and told me, and she was a bit apprehensive, as I guess all mothers would be. I don't think she liked the war, but she never said that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was the same way. My dad never spoke about it. You know, they went through a lot to adopt me. My dad was 48 years old when they adopted me. They had gone through Omaha. They had gone all over. And then my mother had worked for a dentist in Sioux City as a dental assistant for a number of years. And I think he had something to do with the adoption because... I was adopted in Iowa for a Nebraska family, which is basically unheard of at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there were a lot of strings pulled, a little background as far as that goes. So they really, I think, were worried about me, but they wouldn't say anything to me about it as far as that goes.
Right. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, what do you remember about the actual in-processing and having to report? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'll take you through it real quick. I was drafted in Omaha at the I can't remember the name of what they call it, but anyway, it took the physical there. They put us up for the night. They put us on a plane the next evening And we flew to Minneapolis. From Minneapolis, we were on a puddle jumper that stopped all the way across western United States, Montana, Idaho, and then finally arrived at Seattle. And we were met at the plane late at night, and it took us all day to get across the country. Mm-hmm. And the first meal I had in the Army was not only my worst, but probably one of my worst. And I think they had been investigated by the Congress. I think they'd had a lot of complaints because they made us eat the meal, and you know, so nobody would claim that they didn't get any food type thing. So,
right.
And then again, I had looked at joining the Navy in the submarine service, and I had really good scores, and I'd looked into that, so I knew I was going to get probably a pretty good job. A friend of mine from Sioux City had been drafted about 6 months to a year, maybe a year earlier, and he had really good scores, and he ended up in the helicopter maintenance field area.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, you know, they're not going to put an individual that's not intelligent enough to do the work. So when I got to Seattle, there Fort Lewis, Washington then, they were taking a number of gentlemen out of my unit there and asking them to re-enlist for 1 year, and you could pick any job you wanted.
Right.
Well, I figured if they're asking me to re-enlist, they've probably got a pretty good job for me anyway, so I refused to re-enlist.
Mm-hmm.
And was going to serve my 2 years as a draftee.
Yes, sir. So you went through your basic at Fort Lewis then?
Fort Lewis, Washington, yes. A-51. I will never forget it.
I know you mentioned that horrible first meal. Do you remember what it was?
No, but it was slop.
Okay.
I was, like I said, as a kid I had I guess what they call a peptic ulcer. Does that make any sense?
Yes, sir.
But anyway, I had trouble with Army food the entire time I was in. I don't ever remember having a good meal until I was medevac from Vietnam, and they put us on an Air Force plane, and we ended up in Japan, and I went, the nurse, I was kind of like walking wounded, I guess is the best way to explain it, and the girl walked me down to the Air Force chow hall, and she says, there's two lines, you can go on either line. I said, well, what's the difference? And she said, well, on the left line, you get, you know, your standard meal, like meat and potatoes and that type of thing. She said, on the right side is hamburgers.
Right.
And I looked at her and I says, I get to choose?
Right.
So I knew I was in the wrong branch of the service.
Right. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about BASIC and what it was like for you?
Sure. We were at BASIC for 10 weeks, not because we did anything wrong, but they had just filled the battalion before we got there. So I was put into the next battalion with about 20 guys, and we had like a week and a half to fill out. It was probably the hardest physical thing I had ever done in my life. In fact, I had lost so much weight. Two reasons, because we were doing a lot of physical activity,
mm-hmm.
but the food wasn't that good, and I didn't eat a whole lot. And they take pictures of you in your uniform and send them home to your parents, and my mother thought she got the wrong picture. I had lost that much weight. It was very demanding. Probably the most demanding thing for me was a thing what they call the low crawl pit.
Okay.
Are you familiar with that at all? Or?
Vaguely. But could
vaguely?
You
okay. It's probably a thing about 25 yards wide, and it's filled with sawdust and that type of thing.
Okay.
And you have to crawl on your belly all the way across until you get to the end. And I just had a heck of a time doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought I'd never make it. And when the day we did it, they put tarps down over the sawdust. So you weren't actually running and crawling across on sawdust. But that physically, that was the toughest thing for me. And the only thing that saved me, I'm not a fast person at all. I've never been able to run. And the only thing that saved me is I had two twin Chinese brothers from California that were in my unit, and they were extremely overweight. They were always slower than me. So that's about the only thing that saved me through basic training. you know, we went through weapons training and that type of thing, all the things that you would give to a normal Army personnel. Mm-hmm. But that roll call pit was probably the thing that sticks out in my mind the most.
Okay.
And then during graduation, Cohen, we kind of have funny stories, but during graduation, you're out on this rock field at Fort Lewis, and they tell you, you know, don't lock your knees. Keep your knees bent, because you're out there for about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, standing in formation at the position of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us, you know, be sure, I don't know how many times they said, don't lock your knees. Well, anyway, we're standing out there, and about 35 minutes into the thing, we hear crash, ding, 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 and one of the officers had fainted, and this helmet rolled off. I always thought that was kind of funny. That, you know, they bugged this into us not to lock our knees, and then the officers are the ones that do.
Right.
Yes,
sir. All right. Well, you mentioned the weapons training. Were you guys training on M14s, M16s?
Yes. In fact, just a quick sidelight.
Okay.
Well, all my training, both at Fort Lewis and Fort Sill, were on M14s.
Okay.
And when I got to Vietnam and they gave me my M16, I didn't know how to operate it. I mean, I knew how to fire it. I mean, it was a gun, but I didn't know how to tear it apart. And they looked at my record, and it had just been signed off by somebody, you know, paper pusher.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's got to be training the M16, so they just signed it off.
Right.
Typical Army.
Right, sir.
As you can tell, I'm not too impressed with the Army.
Well, I know you had a later career as an Air Force man as well.
Yeah. When I joined the Air National Guard, and it was just the difference between night and day.
Okay.
They treated people as human beings rather than as numbers. I guess that's probably the best way to explain it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. I'd be interested to hear more of your comparisons a little later on in the interview.
Sure.
All right. Well, how about could you talk a little bit about your drill instructors, a little bit about those guys? Were they Vietnam veterans?
I had an E6 that was our first drill instructor, and he was about ready to retire, I believe, or not retire. I think he was getting out of the service. He was fed up with it, but he was an E6, and the one story I remember about him is he came up and he kicked me in the shins, and he said, "You don't know how to march," and I felt like telling him, "Listen, I was in band for 8 years. I know the difference between my left foot and my right foot." But he just wanted to pick on somebody. I mean, that I look back on it now, and that's exactly what it was. And the gentleman that came in afterwards, who was an E5, there was an E5 and an E4 that came in after he left, and both had Vietnam service.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Did any of the in the basic, did they ever talk much about Vietnam? Was there ever much mention of it, or was it just your general basic introduction to the Army?
Well, they talked about it. You know, they're always harping at you, you know, about, you know, not only get yourself killed, but you get somebody else, your friends killed. And so they harped on us quite a bit about it. It was a major, how do I say it, topic discussed, I would think, almost every day, as I remember it. I could be wrong on that, but I remember them harping on us all the time.
All right. Well, did any of those drill sergeants that did have experience in Vietnam, did they ever talk about their own experiences to you guys?
You know, as far as individual stories, I don't remember them talking about it at all. I mean, they talked about Vietnam, but as far as individual stories, no, I don't remember anything.
Okay.
And I would think I would have had they brought something like that up.
All right. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, excuse me. Overall, did you feel that the training you received at basic was sufficient as far as preparing you for an introduction to military life?
Yeah, I would say so. Probably, I would guess as high as 90% worth. I think there's some things they delved on that they just really didn't need to push. Again, I'm not saying I'm overly intelligent by any means, but it was so rudimentary, that maybe some people didn't get it. I don't know. But I just thought they had done things, they could have done more things and less things more repetitious, I guess is the best way to
say. Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, any other memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that from Basic?
No, you know, the shots, standing in line for the shots, it was your standard fare as far as basic training, as far as the way I looked at it anyway. So, I've since been down to Lackland to the Air Force basic training, and a lot of their things are similar. So I think basic training is pretty much similar. I at least got that impression anyway.
And you said, well, anything else from BASIC before we move on to AIT?
The only thing, has anybody ever talked about how they pick people for certain things in the Army? Or have you, let me go through it real quick. Maybe you can understand it. But when we were getting ready to graduate from basic training, they take you down to the local theater. It's an Army theater. And they put you in there, and they kept calling guys' names for certain job areas, like, you know, medical and armor and whatever. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't called my name yet, because I thought I was going to get a good job. And they finally called me for artillery, and the only ones that were called after artillery was infantry. So I was very lucky to get what I got anyway. So I was very happy.
Had you filled out, did they have you fill out a dream sheet or a wish list type thing?
You know, I don't remember that they did. I think they were kind of upset with me that I didn't re-enlist for 1 year and serve 3 years rather than two, but I don't remember filling out a dream sheet at all.
Okay. All right. But you were happy with the artillery assignment overall?
At the time, I was very happy with it. Yeah, it was much better than infantry. I got to that point where I got very apprehensive as far as, am I going to end up in infantry? So. And, of course, that was just after Tet, and, you know, they had a lot of, you know, injured and dead, so they were trying to refill their ranks that way.
Well, as you were going through this, through basic training and through advanced individual training, were you thinking that that you probably were going to be going to Vietnam eventually?
I guess I always had that in the back of my mind. I thought that everybody that got drafted was going to Vietnam. So, yeah, I looked at it as probably a foregone conclusion and that's where I was going to end up.
So you went to Fort Sill for AIT?
Fort Sill, yeah, okay. Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
All right. And how long did that training last?
I want to say I extended it by 2 weeks. I went through what they call LPS, which was Leadership Preparation School.
Okay.
They were so short of cadre that they would select certain individuals or they let you volunteer to be like the in-house person for your barracks for your unit, and so I volunteered for that, and so spent an extra 2 weeks. They gave us really kind of a crash course in 2 weeks, which would normally take, I guess, probably 6 or 8. And so I went through that, and the people that I was involved with there, the NCOs, not so much the officers, but the NCOs, I thought were really top-notch instructors. I think they kind of put the cream of the crop in that school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through that, and then when I came out, I was kind of what they call, I guess, a platoon leader.
Okay.
And then went through the basic artillery course with the rest of the people, helping them along.
Okay, sir. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about that the artillery training, what that was like?
It wasn't so much classroom. We did have classroom time, but a lot of it was out in the field,
mm-hmm.
Actually prepping on the artillery pieces. The basic course, I think, just covers the 105 howitzer.
Okay. Okay.
And, of course, that's what I was stationed at in Vietnam, so I was fairly familiar with it. But they gave us a lot of field time, but they didn't give us a lot of shooting time. In other words, we'd go out in the field and pretend to shoot the weapon and that type of thing. But I thought they could have dedicated more time to the actual firing of the weapon itself. But I thought the training was good. I wouldn't consider it excellent. I think there's a lot of things they left out as far as once I got to Vietnam. There's a number of things I picked up more from Vietnam than in actual combat, which, you know, they can't duplicate combat in a schoolroom atmosphere. They just can't do it. And the training was good. I'm trying to think of other things that we went through. Boy, not off the top of my head, I can't.
Was the with this training, was it somewhat Vietnam specific as far as the way the artillery would operate in Vietnam, or again more general?
No, it was really general. It was general stuff: how to fire the weapon, how to you know, stake it out when you first get there. It was that type of thing. I don't think they could have duplicated, because I have talked to people in artillery units. I was way up north. I was up in I Corps, and it's all mountains, Oshawa Valley, that type of thing. And the firing was so much different than the firing down, like, say, in the Delta, when they were on, you know, actually kind of like wooden boats. And so it was, I don't see how they could have duplicated it. It just, it had been way too much.
Okay. Well, not to jump too far ahead here with this question, but looking back from your perspective now, how do you think they could have improved it? What could they have included that would have been helpful for service in Vietnam, do you think?
I think almost all of my unit that I served with in Fort Sill, almost all of them went to Vietnam. There were a few that went to Germany, and who later I found out ended up in Vietnam anyway. But they could have given us a better background of the country. There's, while I'm talking to you here, I'm looking for a book. A gentleman by the name of Stanley Karnoff. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes, sir. Right. Yep.
He has written a book, which I've read over and over, Vietnam, A Television History.
Right.
If they could have... Of course, it wasn't written at that time, but if they could have done more about that, I would have had a better understanding of the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think I would have been better equipped to serve in that country and do what I did. They were very basic on their instructions of what was happening in Vietnam and that type of thing.
Okay.
I think they could have greatly improved that.
How about things like, and I know it's not a soldier's job to question why and the purpose and all that, but did they give you guys any sort of background about what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam? Was there any talk about any of that?
You know, I don't remember any political, I guess that's on the political side, but any political ramifications of what we were doing. It was basically like you said, if you were a private in the Army, you're supposed to do what the guy over you, which was very hard for me. And I had a tendency to question, well, why are we doing this? Well, what, you know, and when I got to Vietnam, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but when I get to Vietnam, they wouldn't even tell us where we were at. I mean, it just... and that's very difficult for me. I'm trying to write the history of the unit and to go back now and try to piecemeal where everything else is. And,
right.
You know, I remember I was on a tall mountaintop when we first got there and that type of thing, but they never told us the name. They left their younger people in just a questionable type. And I always tried to rectify that when I was a senior NCO in the Air Force, or in the Air National Guard. I always tried to let people know what we were doing, where we're going, why are we doing it. You know, the NCOs in the Army never cared about that, never cared about their people.
Yes, sir. All right. Would you think that, I guess, a little bit of an introduction about the culture and maybe a little bit about the language would have been something that would have been very beneficial to the guys going over?
Well, I think so. You know, if they would have just taught us in Vietnam how to say hi, thank you, you know, that type of thing, I think it would have put us on a much better footing with the locals. And that's from my perspective.
All right. Well, once you completed the AIT, was it at that point that you received the assignment to Vietnam?
Yes. I think it was at the end of the artillery course. They, again, called us into, I think it was a theater or something, and gave us orders for either Vietnam or Germany or wherever we were going.
Okay. All right. Once you...
I don't remember anybody from my unit staying at Fort Sill or getting orders for an artillery unit in the States. I think all of us were sent overseas, either to Vietnam or Germany.
Well, once you actually received the assignment and finally knew that you were definitely going to Vietnam, what was your reaction at that point? Do you remember?
Well, I wasn't scared. I was, again, I would call myself more apprehensive than anything else. But, you know, it's like you said earlier, orders flow downhill and you're ordered to do it, you go do it, you know. I wasn't really scared. I just was a bit apprehensive of what was next in store for me.
Right. Okay. All right. Did you have much time off between AIT and going to Vietnam?
I think I had about maybe 2 weeks. I mean, it could have been more, but I think it was around 2 weeks, and I went back to my parents' home in South Sioux. Stay there.
Well, what was the actual trip over like? Could you talk about the actual journey getting there to Vietnam?
Okay. I left South Sioux, and they flew me to San Francisco, and we ended up at what they call the Oakland Army Terminal.
Okay.
And from there, we were shipped overseas. We went, I think, up to... try to think of the air base. It's north of San Francisco. Travis,
okay,
I think.
Travis, yeah.
And from Travis, we went to Japan. And from Japan, then we ended up in Vietnam. It wasn't a military flight. It was a contracted civilian air carrier.
Okay.
And one quick story. We were coming in to Vietnam, and I think we flew into Thompson Newt. I think that's where we flew in.
Okay.
And I looked down through the clouds, and I could see the smoke coming up. And I thought, my God, the city's under attack. We'll be killed. And I didn't realize they were burning shit at the time.
Right.
But it scared the hell out of me.
Sure.
And all I could think of was, if we get off this plane, where am I going to get my weapon so I can shoot somebody? You know,
right.
Protect.
Once you actually stepped off of the plane, what was your impression of the country at that point upon arrival?
It was like, the thing I would consider it most, it was like we went back two centuries in time, I just thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, in 68, a lot of things hadn't been built up yet, and I think we landed at Thompson Newt, but I don't even remember there being a operation center of a place. I remember they're putting us on buses, on school buses and army school buses, and putting us on there. And I remember the metal that was attached to the windows that was welded in so they couldn't throw grenades into the bus.
Right.
And they took us to, I think it was a place, I should have had my book out here. I've tried to track back of where I came into country and that type of thing, and haven't had a whole lot of luck. But they took us to a center and for delving out to the different divisions.
Okay.
And they took us, I remember they were building a swimming pool for the officers, not for the enlisted people, but they were building a swimming pool for the officers.
Right.
And we worked on details for, I want to say, a day or two. It couldn't have been over 2 days.
Okay.
And then I got assigned, my orders came down, and I got assigned to the 101st Airborne Division.
Okay.
And at that standpoint, then I left there, and I went over to, they had the 101st Airborne Division had a school where everybody that came in country went through the school, and it kind of acclimated you to the thing, and they gave you a lot of training, and it was probably one of the finest schools that I'd been through in the Army, believe it or not. And I apologize, I can't think of the name of that school right now, but I'll try to get it for you.
All right.
And that, we were there, I think, an extra week or two, and then I was shipped up country to I Corps and to the 101st Airborne Division.
Could you talk, I guess, just a little bit more about the acclimation school and some of the things that they were teaching you there during that?
They taught us to actually kind of like go out and patrol, and you're set up on a patrol basis and walking through jungle.
Okay.
And they would have trips there like the VC would have or the NVA, and you would have to walk point and you know, catch those trips before you trip them and that type of thing. So it was very inclusive as far as it related directly to what was going on in the field. And I'm trying to think, that's the thing I remember most, is doing that walking like we were grunts. And they did have some classroom work, and they showed us how when you were out on perimeter, how to watch for things on perimeter, that type of thing.
Any talk there, or any lessons, or were you guys taught anything there about the Vietnamese, about local culture, things like that?
No, okay. That was strictly military and what you were going to do, and once you get to the field, this is how it's going. It wasn't no.
Okay. All right. And what was the specific unit you were assigned? I know you said 101st, but...
I was assigned to A Battery, 2nd 320th Artillery with the 101st Airborne Division.
Okay.
And we were in the 1st Brigade, and it was a 105 outfit. We fired artillery for the 1st of the 327th,
okay.
And the 2nd of the 50 Deuce, and the 1st of the 50 Deuce, I think. Those were the three. Each artillery unit had three infantry units that they fired for.
Okay. All right. And how did you get up north?
We flew by, I think, C-130s. Okay. I think they flew us by C-130s from Thompson Oak to Phu Bai, which was just outside of Camp Eagle.
Okay. All right. So where were you actually based then?
Mainly in my first unit or first fire base that I went to was out in the what they call the Oshawa Valley.
Okay. Right.
And we were there for a while, and the monsoons hit.
Okay.
And we were on such a tall mountain that the clouds were underneath us, and
oh, wow. Okay.
And we couldn't get resupplied. That was our big problem. They couldn't get food and water to us, and. We ended up drinking the water off the tarps. I mean, it was bad. And they actually had, to tell you, kind of give you what artillerymen versus infantrymen, the cloud cover was underneath, so the resupply helicopters should get to a lower helicopter pad.
Okay.
And so they wanted volunteers from the infantry unit that was on our hill and the artillery unit to go down and hike down and get this food and bring it back up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was such late in the day that they hiked down there, and coming back up at night, they couldn't get back. But every artillery guy got back to the unit. They were so scared.
Right.
They wanted to get back to the base. And every artillery guy, but the infantry guys were spread out all over the thing and actually ended up on the night spent out there, but that's how bad it was. And there wasn't any Army officers, I don't think, have any forward looking capabilities. Air Force officers not only are trying to fix the problems they have now, but they're trying to look on to see, hey, where's the next problem and what can I do to help it out before it even happens? Army officers aren't like that. And I think that's a nature of the different branches of the service.
All right. Okay.
And then,
go ahead.
That was my first base. And then from there, we were transferred back down to Highway 1.
Okay.
And I was on a number of fire bases, a place called Tomahawk and Los Banos.
Okay.
And I didn't realize at the time how they were naming these fire bases. Well, if you look back in the history of the 101st Airborne, it was a lot of places that they had been in World War II, which I found out later. I didn't know at the time. And then it was a series of fire bases, and we got attacked one night. To give you a background on how we were attacked, when I first went over there, we were mortared at least maybe three times or more a week from the enemy. When I left Vietnam 13 months later, we were lucky if we were getting mortared once a month.
Oh, wow.
So that's how the war had changed over that 12 or 13 months that I was in combat.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, once you went up country, up there to I Corps, did you go immediately upon arrival there up to the fire base in the Ashall, or was there a little time there at Phu Bai?
Maybe a day. We went from Phu Bai to Camp Eagle. In Camp Eagle, I met with my first sergeant, that was first sergeant of the of A Battery,
mm-hmm.
who had been there forever. I don't know if he had gotten trouble in the States or what, but he was like an E-7, and he had been permanently there. They said he'd been there since like 65.
Wow.
And he did not resupply me very well, nor did there were three of us that went to the unit. And I don't remember him giving us anything at all. Maybe some, like a rucksack and that type of thing. But we got out to the unit, and the guy says, "Well, where's your cot?" I said, "Well, they didn't give me any cot." The Army just, I don't know. Excuse my French, but they have their head up their ass. You know?
All right.
when I was a senior NCO in the Air National Guard, we always took care of our troops, you know? And if some young kid didn't have a cot, I'd give him my cot, you know? But that isn't the Army way as far as the NCOs go. As you can see, I'm very bitter about the Army. It's about taking care of your troops, and they didn't take care of us.
Right. All right.
I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but can I give you one other story?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
I had four commanders in Vietnam, four battery commanders, and only one of them was worth a shit. And you know, when he came out to the unit, I got to know him fairly well, and he said, "Well, when's steak night?" And I looked at him and I said, "Steak night?" I said, "We don't get steak." He says, "Army regulations said we're supposed to get steak once a week." I says, "I've been here 7 months and I've never had steak once." Well, what happened was the cooks were cooking them for themselves back in the river.
I see.
And what was supposed to happen is they were supposed to have a day off. They'd send the steaks out and we'd barbecue them and cook our meal. I mean, they'd make like the potatoes and stuff, but they'd supposed to, well, believe me, that got changed. And I know 1 week we had steak three times in 1 week, but that's how, you know, the whole thing. I can see why we lost the war. You know, we didn't take care of anybody.
Right.
But anyway, that's a side story. Sorry.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, could you talk? excuse me. Could you talk a little bit more about the fire base there? I know you talked about it being on top of a hill, but about the quarters, the housing, what type of food you guys were actually getting most of the time, that type of thing.
Okay, I got to laugh. You said housing. There was we slept in bunkers.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, how they build a fire base is they take a mountaintop.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring a 500-pound bomb in by helicopter, and they drop it on the top of the mountain.
Okay.
The explosive guys come in and set it and blow it up, so that gets enough room for usually a road grader to be helicoptered out and lifted on the hill. And then he bulldozes the mountain big enough to put an artillery unit on there. And I would say where our firing batting was from one edge to the other edge was probably 30 yards, 30 by 30 maybe. And then, of course, we have our ammo dump that they make. But we lived in bunkers. Do you know what PSP is? Perforated steel planking.
Okay, right.
Okay. That's what we use for a roof. And then on top of that, we would lay plastic sheets down, and then we'd put sandbags, usually, I think, two or three at least, on top of that. And then we lived in those bunkers. Well, what they did is when our artillery rounds came in, they came in wooden boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And we would tear those wooden boxes apart to make walls and that type of thing. So it was very rudimentary. I'm trying to think of anything else. Maybe questions you might have. They had the ammo dump. They had operations, which contained the commander and what they call FDC, Fire Direction Control.
Okay.
And then they had the guns. And then sometimes for protection, we would have, I think this only happened once, but we would have like a Quad 50, which is a 50 caliber anti-aircraft gun.
Okay.
And they brought that out to the base to keep firing down so the enemy wouldn't crawl up the mountain. But that first fire base I was on, it was the highest fire base that I had ever been on, and I probably in Vietnam.
Okay.
But we fired artillery down into the Oshawa Valley.
Okay.
And I think the mountain was so steep that they just couldn't climb it, and that's the only reason we never got attacked. We'd get mortared, but we wouldn't get attacked.
But was it kind of on the edge of the Oshawa, or were actually in it?
It was actually on the edge. I would think it would be on one of the mountaintops that would be down. And I have tried to find the name of it. I think it was called Eagle's Nest, I think.
Okay.
Don't quote me for sure on that, but I think that's the first one we were at.
Okay. Had the unit been there very long when you arrived?
No. They were just building the base as we got there.
Okay. Not to get too far ahead, but how long did you remain there?
Probably, I'm guessing maybe 2 months. While I'm talking to you, I'm looking through the book I'm writing, and
sure.
Maybe can try to. I know you like to have exact dates and figures and everything else. So
it doesn't have to be. But,
okay. And the other thing is, I don't know if you're aware of it, but in an Army unit. Somebody at battalion headquarters is designated as the historian.
Okay.
And the historian is supposed to write down everything that happens. Like, if there's an attack, he's supposed to write down the A battery was attacked on this date, and there were so many deaths, and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these guys did it as an extra duty, and it is so poorly written. It's pathetic. I would have taken a lot more time and research to do it. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, could you talk, I guess, a little bit about your first impression of the unit itself, of the battery itself, and of the guys? You don't have to use specific names if you don't want to, but some of the characters that you ran into there.
Okay. Well, when I was first over there, I was trained as what they call a 13 Alpha 10, which is a gun plumber. I fired the artillery unit, the weapon.
Okay.
And when I first got over there, we only had five guns, which normally a 105 howitzer unit has six guns. The battery was considered a hard luck battery, and the reason I say that is previous to my coming over there, they had been overrun one time, and they'd lost, I think, one or two guns. They didn't lose the position, but they lost a couple guns, and the NVA had attacked them, overran them. Then, later on in 68, they went to this place called Birmingham Fire Base, and they were on the base, and the Marine, I think it was the Marines, I don't mean to say anything incorrect, but the Marines dropped two 500-pound bombs on them, and killed a number of them and wounded a bunch.
Right.
And there again, the unit was undermanned type thing. And my first 6 to 8 months over there, we were just so short of men, it was pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I blame that a lot on the battery commander, the captain that was in charge when I first got over there.
Mm-hmm.
because when they got burned, again, I didn't know this until after I came back and I'd done research, but the battery commander wanted the battery to stand up right away after they had been bombed by these 2 500-pound bombs. Mm. And he should have taken his time and said, hey, we need people, we need stuff, but he was gung-ho at the expense of his enlisted men. What was I talking about? I'm sorry. I get off on tangents. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. I was just asking about some of the different guys in the unit and things.
People. I don't remember a whole lot of guys from the guns.
Okay.
So many. Everybody over there had a nickname. You didn't call him by Fred Smith. He was Smitty or. But I do have a listing of some of the men. That I found in my research. None of my officers or NCOs or fellow batterymen stand out to me at all, I'll be honest with you. Not until I was cross-trained into FDC, Fire Direction Control.
Okay.
And once I got in that, that's when it really felt like a unit. I mean, we were doing things, we were firing artillery and we're trying to kill the enemy. That was our job. And until I got into FDC, which was probably about 6 months into my tour, that's when I really felt, it really felt like I was doing something. It just, it's hard to say. But and then I ran into a gentleman by the name of Larry Hoy, H-O-Y, who... We still correspond each Christmas. We send Christmas cards back and forth, believe it or not, after this many years.
Mm-hmm.
And became a very good friend of him. And then I had the third commander that we had, a gentleman, he was a captain at that time. He retired a lieutenant colonel. But his name was Clarence R. Buchwald, B-U-C-H-W-A-L-D. And he retired a lieutenant colonel, but he was probably the finest commander that I ever had. I would say he is the finest commander I ever had in the Army.
Okay.
But the unit was considered a hard luck because so many bad things happened to him. At that time, Captain Buchwald, I thought, really pulled the unit together. And I mean, we could fire. It was a different unit under him. He really had a cohesion. And the reason he came to the unit, he wasn't even supposed to come to our unit, but they had some, I didn't realize at the time, they had some drug problems. And he was sent out to the unit because the veteran commander that was out there got fired.
Okay.
And he really turned the unit around, I thought. I consider him at that time probably had one of the best firing batteries in the entire Vietnam War.
When you first arrived there, being a new guy in country, how were you received? Were you treated with any of the, the FNG kind of attitude?
I think that was peripherated in the entire Army, and I think in all units, you're considered a cherry. And I think until you proved yourself, or they just didn't really trust you. They didn't want to get killed, and they didn't want you getting them killed, I guess is maybe the best way to put it.
All right. How long did it take for you to be accepted?
Good question. I would say maybe 60 to 90 days at least.
Okay. All right.
And that's a guesstimate.
Would a big part of that be just proving that they could trust you, proving that you were reliable under fire, that type of thing?
I guess that's the gist of it. I never understood it. We had fired artillery in Fort Sill, so we knew, what to do. We had had a couple of times that rounds had hit friendlies.
Okay.
And what happens at that time, they shut everything down. You cannot touch the guns. You cannot do anything. FDC. And both times, it was done by the forward observer. He didn't know where he was at. He fired in the wrong direction. And again, so much of that's not their fault because they're in triple canopy or You know, they don't know where they're at. Well, you know, I would think you'd fire a phosphorus round first to find out where you're at, but, you know, it costs in more time, it doesn't happen that way, so.
Right. All right. Well, again, with the whole new guy kind of thing, would they just mostly just not talk to you at first? Is that what it was, or did it go beyond that?
I guess that, and I had a, when I was on the guns, the first gun commander, or NCO that was there, he was an E6. He was getting short, so he went back to the rear, and they had promoted a guy that was on the guns by the name of Sergeant Perez. He was an E5.
Okay.
But see, normally that position is like an E6 or E7 position, and that's how bad we were as far as getting new troops out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an all-around guy, and I think things, if I remember right, things kind of improved around him, again, because, number one, he was new,
right.
and I'd been there a little bit of time, anyway.
Okay. All right. Well, overall, once you were accepted as a member of the unit, did you say that did everyone seem to get along pretty well, or were there problems? Were there things like racial tension, any problems, any things like that?
You know, I don't remember any the entire time I was there. I don't remember of any racial tensions. I mean, we had people that were pissed at each other, you know, that, you know, which is normal. But as far as racial tensions, I don't remember any at all. You got to remember, most of these guys were airborne paratroopers. They were, you know, jumped out of airplanes. They were crazy anyway. So, I think they grew together a lot better than maybe a regular leg unit. I still, to this day, think I was probably in the best firing unit in the entire Vietnam War. But,
yes, sir.
But I think a lot of that. I always say the 101st saved my life. You know, they were always ready to kick ass, you know, first, and then take names later. And I think that what saved a lot of us from maybe some doom that another artillery unit would have taken.
All right. Well, given that it was, I guess, somewhat late in the war, 68, into 68, how was morale overall with the unit?
My personal opinion, I think it was good. I don't remember really seeing anything anti-war until I got back in late 69. You know, they told us to be careful around San Francisco, the airport, and that type of thing.
Right.
But I don't remember of individuals talking anti-war or anything like that in the unit at all.
Okay. And I know you mentioned earlier about a little bit about the drug issues. Had that mostly been resolved by the time you had gotten there, or were there still some problems?
Some of that happened after I was in the unit. I know that there were some people, they didn't want anybody on the guns or in FDC, you know, smoking dope. That was a no-no. And I don't remember, when I was in, I don't remember any people in my little unit, in my artillery piece, ever smoking dope.
Okay.
And then I was transferred to FDC, and I don't remember anybody in there ever smoking dope. But I think, I know in talking to my commander, there were some problems. I think it was in the ammo dump. I think there were some guys down there that had not only smoking problems, but I think there was one gentleman that was hooked on heroin. I can't prove that. I don't know that it happened, but Captain Buckwald would be, or Colonel Buckwald would be, another good one to ask. They never told the privates anything.
Right.
They never told us where we were at. They never told us there was any drug calls.
All right. Well, I guess now if you could talk a little bit about your specific duties as an artilleryman on the gun. What your daily routine would be like, and what your specific duties were.
Usually in the late afternoon, early evening, they would send down what they call, I'm trying to think what they call them now, fire support missions.
Okay.
And what it was is when the infantry would walk for so long during the day, then at night they would set up a position and put defensive positions around it. And we would fire artillery in support of them. So, like, say, 5, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening, we would fire artillery rounds around them to make sure that we knew exactly where we were firing. So if something happened during the night and they needed to call us, it'd be ready and available. So we would fire DTs, they call them DTs, defensive targets.
Okay.
And we would fire those in the late afternoon and then again at night if needed. So it wasn't unusual to get woken up at like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning and fire rounds for the infantrymen that were in place. During the day, you would resupply your artillery rounds. We would have to hump down the hill to the ammo dump and load up on our backs the rounds, and we would stack them. The 105 artillery rounds about three and a half feet long,
okay,
in a rounded tube, cardboard tube, and you would put one on each shoulder, and then they would stack 4 or 5 or 6 on the back of your head and neck, and then you would walk up the hill with those on your back, and that's how we resupplied our spent rounds.
Okay.
And again, we would, if the infantry was out during the day and they were walking and they'd come under fire by enemy, they would use us to fire in the enemy's direction, so we would have fire missions during the day too.
All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about the gun crew itself? How many people would be on the gun, and what would the different duties be?
Okay. Well, there'd be, I guess you want to call it, the commander of the gun. He was the top NCO, and he would give the direction and azimuth down as far as where we were firing, and then he would tell us to fire. There was a gunner that was on a position to the left of the, as the artillery piece is facing out, in other words, as the barrel is facing out toward the enemy. On the left side, there's what they call the gunner, and he has a eyepiece that he uses to adjust the firing round from the order from the sergeant. And then on the right side is the guy that runs the azimuth, the up and down of the cannon. And then the other people are the, like, you have an ammo guy that gets the ammo ready. Usually they use just an impact fuse. In other words, once the round hits the ground, it explodes.
Okay.
They can put a timing fuse on too, and that ammo guy is responsible for that. And then the other guys just help out whatever they need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Guy that loads the weapon, that type of thing.
Okay.
In my section, when I was there, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There were 6 guys in the gun, and I think there's normally supposed to be like 8.
Okay. All right. And again, your what you would be doing.
I would either load the gun or do whatever they needed to do.
Okay. All right. And okay. Did you talk about about the procedure for actually firing a round, if you could, from the point of getting a target to actually firing the shell? Could you describe that?
Okay. What would happen is, in what we call FDC, Fire Direction Control, there's the radio operators, and they're in constant contact with the infantry, or there's a higher headquarters of the artillery, too, and they have a radio that talks to them. But normally, the conversations between the infantry and us would be on this one radio, and that message would come in, and they had big plotting maps.
Okay.
And they would plot where the infantry was, and then if they knew there were enemy in a certain area, they would plot that. And then there's a metal thing that there's a point at where the base is that's the middle of the map. And then this thing would metal thing would come around, and it would give you the information that you needed as far as how to fire the piece, what azimuth, what angle, and how high up, and what charge. Artillery rounds have charges in them. They're little pockets of firepower, gunpowder.
Okay.
And you could do like a charge three, which means there's three charges in the tube, and that's how you get the artillery piece to fire. And there's a book that you go to that gives you all that information.
Okay.
And so they would say, you know, a fire mission, and they would give the location of the enemy, and they would plot that. Then those individuals would give the information to the head NCO of the FDC, and he would pass that on down to operations. Operations, they call him the sergeant of fire sergeant, and he would pass that out to the guns, and that's how an artillery unit is fired.
Okay. All right. And were there different? I know you talked about you could have a time delayed fuse or an impact shell. But could you talk a little bit about the different types? Were there different types of rounds? And if so, could you talk about?
There were a couple of different types. The majority of the things we fired was what we call an HE round, high explosive. Mm-hmm. But they had a round. When I was talking earlier about the unit getting overrun, mm-hmm. they have what they call a flechette round. And basically what it is it's an artillery round that's filled with nails.
Okay.
And it's fired in the direction of enemy that are approaching. And we had those. And we had WP, which is white phosphorus.
Right.
And that's how the infantry a lot of times could tell where they were. They'd have this fire WP with a time fuse, and it would burst above them or near them, and that way they could tell where they're at.
And how about different types of fire missions? Were there what different types of fire missions would there be?
Well, there's your standard fire mission, and that would be against enemy known enemy in the area.
Okay.
You'd have DTs, which is defensive targets. Those you fire in the late afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of anything else. I think probably those were the main two missions.
Okay. What about did you guys fire? Harassment and interdiction fire as well?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I forgot all about this. It's been too long.
That's fine. Right.
We would fire. Those would come down. I talked to you about we had a higher headquarters.
Uh-huh.
And those would come down from higher headquarters. And I don't know how they picked them, but we would fire them at night. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm sorry. I completely spaced those off.
Not at all. All right. Let's see. Okay. Well, any memorable fire missions or memorable events from this first fire base you were stationed on?
The only thing I knew is when we did have a fire mission, it would last long.
Okay.
And we expended a lot of rounds. And our artillery tube is just like a gun. You know, you can only fire so many rounds through it, and then it has to be either melted down and done over again or whatever, because it becomes inaccurate after so many rounds. But we had to count the number of rounds you fired and at what powder. And but I know we did, when I first got over there, we fired a lot.
Okay. All right. And I know you mentioned you guys were coming under mortar fire quite a bit
mm-hmm.
here. Okay. Could you talk a little bit about what you guys would do when coming under mortar fire? What would be the response to that?
For sure. Well, a couple things. They're around where the artillery piece, we had what we call M102As.
Okay.
Which was an artillery piece that could fire at 360 degrees. It had a big tire on the back of it, and it could be wheeled around.
Okay.
Well, outside of that wheel in the fire area, we would dig a, like, not a bunker, but we would dig a little line that would be around it. And you could go hide in there if it was if we had incoming. Usually we went to the bunkers. The bunkers were the safest place, so... I would say 9 times out of 10, we were always in the bunker.
Okay.
Which didn't mean too much because our artillery, our little ammo place for the guns was right next to the bunker. So if they ever hit that ammo.
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right.
I never figured out the Army and their safety.
Right. Anyway, how about, were there ever any actual infantry attacks against the
Federals? None while I was over there in 68, late 68 and 69, none.
Okay.
Well, no, I shouldn't say that. We were moving from one base to another base, and part of our unit was on Tomahawk, which was next to Highway 1, and they came under attack one night, but I was not at the, I was at the other location at that time. So
okay.
I personally did not come under any infantry attack.
Okay. All right. How would you guys move from one firebase? Would it be by helicopter? Or?
Yes. Almost everything exclusive was by helicopter. You would pack everything up and put it in a... all these like airplane strap things, and then the helicopters would pick it up and transfer it to the next base. The artillery pieces would be moved by helicopter. The ammo would be moved by helicopter. Almost everything. We didn't have a vehicle in the field as I can ever remember.
Okay. All right. And once you guys moved from that fire base in the Asheville, near the Asheville, where did you go to next?
We went from there, and I think the name of it was Eagle's Nest.
Okay.
And from there, we moved to a place called Tomahawk.
Okay.
Firebase Tomahawk. Mm-hmm. These were all located in I Corps, and we were there probably, I want to say, like maybe 2 to maybe 3 months. And from there, we moved to a place called Los Banos,
right,
which was south on Highway 1. And it was the first major fire base north of the big Marine Corps place, the name.
Okay.
And we were there. And now that was... that actually had a building on it, believe it or not. They had made a... the people that were there before us had made a wooden chow hall, and they'd actually, you know, you could eat in American standards, I guess, the best way to explain. They did send out our cooks then, and the cooks actually were in the field at that time. Before that, we would always be resupplied by helicopter in the late afternoons with a hot meal. We'd get one hot meal a day in the evening.
Right.
And they would send them in these metal tins, and you would just stand in line and get your food and then eat with your mess kit. For breakfast and lunch, we had C rations. And we ate C rations. And there was a couple of different ways they did it. When I was on the guns, this one sergeant, he would take the C ration box. I think there were like 12 meals in a box. And he would flip the box over,
mm-hmm,
and then you would pick just whatever meal.
Okay.
Well, you know, you may, for breakfast, you might get pork. You know, it just, it wasn't, to me, it wasn't. Ultimately, they started giving each of us a full box of 12, and then there were usually two breakfast meals in there, and you could eat a breakfast meal that way.
Okay.
It'd be like scrambled eggs and ham or something like that. They weren't very good either.
Well, how about the hot meals? Were they any good at all, or no?
They were pretty good. I mean, it was so much better than sea rations that you didn't really want to complain. But, I went on a detail one time. I remember this. I went on a detail and I came back and they'd already fed everybody in the unit,
mm-hmm,
and the only thing left was asparagus. And as a kid, I could never eat asparagus, but.
Right.
I found out as an individual, if you're hungry enough, you'll eat anything.
Right.
And, you know, I had 3 plate loads of asparagus. Today I could eat asparagus, but, you know, the NCOs, they knew there were like 4 of us that were on detail and they were going to be back late. They should have saved food for us. But the NCOs had their, excuse my French, they had their head up their ass.
Right. All right.
Am I too colorful?
No, not at all. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
Well, I know you mentioned the sea rations and turning them upside down. Could you talk a little bit more about those? What were some of the sea rations that guys liked and some that you guys didn't like? If you could talk a little about
there was
that.
There was a beef stew that was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
I remember the one thing they always wanted to trade for. You probably know what a sea ration is, but there are little things in different metal containers, the little cups. And there was pound cake, and people would trade like two meals for one pound cake. I mean, it was quite a deal. I like pound cake, but I don't like it that much. I always traded it for something else.
Right.
The worst, I don't remember the other meals. Oh, chicken and noodles was good.
Uh-huh.
The one meal that was just almost unedible was the pork. It was so greasy and so fatty. I tried everything. When my mother said, "What do you need?" I said, "Send as much spices as you can, like 57 sauce and A1 and Worcestershire sauce, so we could cover the meal, the taste of the meal."
Right. All right. Jeez. All right. Well, I guess if you could talk a little bit about your other job a little bit later on, about when you were transferred to the FDC, if you could talk about what your duties were there.
In about 6 months, most of the guys that were in FDC were leaving. I mean, there was probably, I would say, maybe 12 to 15 people in FDC, and they were almost all going home at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew they weren't going to be resupplied with people from the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't remember. Somebody came to me and said, "We understand you have a year of college." And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, did you have any math?" And I said, "Well, I had trig in high school." I said, "I had 4 years of math in high school, including trigonometry." And I said, "I had, the first year of math in college." I can't think of what they call it now. But anyway, I had that. And he said, "Well," he said, "would you like to cross-train into the FDC?" He said, "We'll teach you how to do it." And those guys were just the neatest bunch of guys. But they were different than the guys on the guns. They were, I think, better educated people.
Mm-hmm.
And I often thought, I can't tell you this for sure, but when they found out I had been to college, there was kind of a little wall between me and the rest of the guys on the guns. Most of the guys were either out of high school or maybe didn't make it through high school. You don't have to be very intelligent to be an artillery. And I always felt there was this kind of wall because I had college education. Neither one of my NCOs had any college at all, and the first sergeant didn't have any college, which really surprised me because you get in the Air Force and, man, everybody has college, and, you know, some have master's degrees. But anyway, but when I went into FDC, it was just a brighter group of people, and they were more educated, and they wanted to know how things operated, I guess is the basic thing. And so they brought me in there, and they taught me how to be an FDCman, how to chart, how to do that. And I had always been around maps quite a bit, and they loved the fact that I liked to make maps.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always making map boards. They got a kick out of that. And then they put me in charge of the generators. The FDC needed lights, and, you know, 24 hours a day. So I was known as the generator man, and I did all the, you know, I'd been around engines quite a bit, so I knew what to do and how to change oil and how to check them and everything else.
All right. Well, could you describe the FDC itself, the facility? And I don't know, I guess some of the different jobs that people would have in the FDC.
When we were on Tomahawk, our room was about, I would say, it might be smaller than 20 by 20.
Okay.
But the charting maps were in there, and you usually had two guys, one on each map. You usually had two guys on the radios, and then you had the FDC officer, which is usually a second lieutenant, a first lieutenant, or sometimes a captain. And then you had the NCOIC, and then we also had what we call a FADAC computer.
Okay.
I worked on that not a lot, but I probably did that more than anything else. And that was to double check the guys they were on the maps to make sure they were getting the right information.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, how that would do that? How would it check them? How did it work?
Well, the computer, the FEDAC computer would give you, you know, azimuth and longitude and that type of thing.
Okay.
And they were on little digits. It was like a circular thing in there. I don't know exactly how it worked, but it was like a huge disk in there, and it would spit out, you'd plug in the coordinates, and it would spit out the information. I don't know how it worked, but it worked. And sometimes we would fire information off the FADAC computer, and sometimes we would fire it off the maps.
Okay. All right. And so, say, a request for fire support, would it come in, would it come directly to you guys?
Sometimes it would. If it was from the infantry units in the field, it would come direct to us because
okay.
there was a radio, what they call an RTO, radio telephone operator, and he would call it in direct from the field into us. A lot of the fire missions would come from, like, say, our headquarters, and it would come back from there. But, you know, if the infantry was in trouble, they'd want us right away. They'd get on the phone and call us direct
mm-hmm.
or on the radio.
All right. So you began this job when you were still on Tomahawk at that point?
I was trained in FDC on Tomahawk.
Ah, okay.
But in actuality, when I went to Los Banos, that was my first FDC. That's when I first got into my first missions and that type of thing.
Okay. All right. Well, before asking you any more about that, anything memorable that stands out in your mind from Tomahawk?
Other than the fact that when they got attacked that one time, and I think there was one individual that was killed. But again, I wasn't there at the time. I was down the road probably about 10, 15 miles. So that was probably the one sore point about Tomahawk. And I don't know if you know, there's a book. After we left, this was quite a bit of time after we left, but there was a Kentucky Army Guard artillery unit that was stationed there, and they got overrun. And there's a book out about it, and let me give you the name of it real quick. It's very, you can pick it up usually on Amazon.com. It's called The Sons of Bardstown, Bardston, and it's by a gentleman by the name of Jim Wilson. And that's the location that we were at when we left for Los Banos, and they came in afterwards and got overrun. It wasn't a very smart location.
And about where was Tomahawk again?
It was, I would say it would be probably equidistant between Fubai and Da Nang.
Okay.
On Highway 1.
Okay. All right.
And that's just purely a guess. It's somewhere in that area.
From the time you were there and the Eagle's Nest, about enemy incoming, was it about the same, worse, better, or?
Tomahawk was probably about the same as Eagle's Nest,
okay.
fairly close, maybe a little bit down at the time, a little bit less than Eagle's Nest. Eagle's Nest, we were getting hit pretty good. So it was less than Eagle's Nest.
I guess switch gears a little bit here. If you could talk a little bit about the enemy, your impressions of them from the interaction that you had with them and the way they operated.
We never really saw them. I think they were a fairly good fighting unit. Again, we were fighting NVA. We were not fighting VC. There were very little VC in I Corps. It's not that they didn't have them, it's just that the NVA was so much more prevalent. And you just never saw them. I mean, you'd get reports of them, they'd blow up bridges, and you just never see them. You know, it just they were kind of like a silent war.
Okay.
It's not like World War II where they knew who the Japanese were and they dressed and that type of thing.
And could you talk a little bit about, I guess as far as whenever they would fire mortars and things that you guys were. What do you know? What type of mortars, and were they also firing rockets and things that you guys as well?
We would get rockets once in a while. On a later trip, when we left Los Banos, the AmeriCal division was just getting their butts kicked. And so they took the whole 1st Brigade of the 101st and went down to help the AmeriCal division. And we were at a couple locations down in their area, and we were at a Special Forces base camp. We set up right next to them.
Okay.
And rockets, 122s, were fired at us that time. I don't remember any rockets being fired up in our northern area at all. It was almost all mortar. And I apologize, I can't tell you what kind it was.
Sure.
Probably 80, I guess.
Okay. All right. How about South Vietnamese troops? Did you guys ever see or have any interaction with them?
Yes. I'm going to tell you, when we went down to support the AmeriCal, they brought a South Vietnamese 105 unit out, and they didn't have any, they didn't have any coordination between the United States Army and themselves.
Okay.
So they wanted two volunteers to go up and stay with the South Vietnamese artillery unit. So I didn't want one of the younger guys getting hurt, so I and another guy volunteered, and we went up and spent probably a week with them. But our whole function up there, it wasn't to fire artillery. They knew how to fire artillery. The guy, the officer, come over and he showed me, and I'd say, yes, I did not speak Vietnamese. But our whole function was, we had a radio up there, and when the helicopters were going in with their gunships or they were taking troops in there, they wanted to make sure they didn't fire, because they were scared to death that they were going to fire around and hit a helicopter or American troops. So my main job up there was just when they called me and said cease fire, I made sure they didn't fire.
Okay.
But I thought they were good artillery. I mean, again, I did not speak Vietnamese. I didn't know half the time what they were talking. I didn't know what I was eating.
So you were eating their rations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
How are they compared to the American rations?
Probably not bad. I had always been, until my later years here, I had always liked spicy food, and my one FDC captain, Samuel Cavillo, Calvillo, was from San Antonio, El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
And he had his mother send a bunch of Mexican food over, because he hadn't had it. So he cooked Mexican food for us one night, and I was eating the hot sauce like crazy, and he said, "How do you do that?" He said, "Mexicans can't eat that hot sauce."
Right.
So I've always been able, but there, again, like I said, I don't know what I was eating. I was probably eating fish and everything else, but it was spicy and it tasted good. You know, anything's better than sea ration.
Right. All right. So overall, from your perspective, from what you could see, you thought that the Arvin that you were working with were competent, I guess, in what they were doing?
Yes, okay. Very much so.
All right. And you said you worked with them about a week?
I think it was about a week. We were on top of this kind of hilltop, and our location was down a little bit from theirs. And I was kind of up on a hill, the hillier top area, and I would just live up there with them for a week.
Okay. Were they fairly friendly and open
yes.
towards you?
Yes, very much so. Very very industrious. Wanted to do a good job, and I was impressed with them. I thought they did a very good job.
All right. Okay. How about Vietnamese civilians? Did you ever have much interaction with them?
Very little. The 101st tried to keep their men away from the villagers and everybody else. So I had very little interaction with locals.
All right. Well, what little you did have, did you have an impression of them, positive, negative, as far as their feelings towards towards you guys and American?
Yeah,
presence?
I wouldn't say positive. I would say neutral.
Okay.
You just, you know, they always talked about them lacing Cokes with acid, and you're just so scared as a young guy. You're just so scared of doing anything. You only drink Coke from a can.
Mm-hmm.
They were just something else. But my, like I said, my with the Vietnamese military, the Arvins, I was very impressed with them.
Okay. All right. When you weren't firing the gun or working in the FTC, if you ever had any downtime, how would you spend it?
Usually, if we tried to sleep, I still have problems sleeping. I'm a person that needs a lot of sleep, and when I was first over there, we were getting like maybe 3 hours of sleep a night. It just was very sleep deprived, and whenever we had extra time off or they didn't have us doing details or anything, I basically slept. I could never get enough sleep, and to this day, I still have problems sleeping.
How about things like writing letters home and things like that? Did you do a good bit of that?
I got chewed out one time for not writing home.
Okay.
I tried to write home. My mother, bless her heart, she would type a letter to me every day and tell me what was going on and send me newspaper articles, but I just didn't write home that much. My dad asked me when I came home, you know, he said, why didn't you write us more about what happened? And I says, because you don't want to know what happened. I said, a lot of the things were just so bad that, you know, I just didn't want to write about it. And he never said anything to me after that.
Right.
His brother came home from World War II and had a very similar, we talked about it a little bit, and he had a very similar deal. He was in the Navy in the Pacific, and a lot of his friends were killed, and he just never wanted to talk about it. I after I was home about 5 years, my dad came to me and he said, you know, there's something wrong with you and you need to find some help. So on my own, I went to a thing called the Siouxland Health Center.
Okay.
And a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, psychologist helped me quite a bit. And a lot of it was getting back from Vietnam and living through it and just think about all the guys that didn't make it. So I was helped at an early age anyway, I guess, with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
Go ahead. Probably shouldn't tell you this, but I came back and I tried to make love to every woman.
Right.
That was my way of getting back.
Right. All right. Well, let's see. Anything memorable, anything we should mention about the time at Los Banos?
Mm-hmm. Not so much. It quieted down. We did what they call a hip shoot, and that's what they do. Is they take a couple guns from a location, and they go to another location, and then they just fire, and then the helicopters come back and pick it up. It's all done in one day.
Okay.
And we went on a hip shoot to this place and fired, and it pissed off the NBA so much it started coming up the mountain at us.
Oh, okay.
And they had cobras flying down the mountain shooting at them. I mean, they were really pissed because we were out there. We weren't supposed to be firing in that area, I guess.
Right.
But that that hip shoot was very reminiscent. And then I ended up getting malaria and falciparum. There's different kinds of malaria. I didn't know that yet. But anyway, they had shipped me back to the rear at July.
Okay.
And the one doctor said I was faking. And the other doctor kind of looked in kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But I ended up with malaria. And they shipped me from July down to a place called 6 C&C. It's a convalescent center.
Okay.
And that was right on the bay at... Cameron. Was it Cameron Bay? I think it was just south of Natrang. Anyway, I'm down there, and we get overrun by VC, and they blow up the water tower and everything else. And God love him, Richard Nixon made a political statement that he was going to withdraw troops from Vietnam. Well, he was. He took all the hospital and all the wounded and shipped them to Japan. So I spent my last month and a half in the Army in Japan. So Richard Nixon saved my life.
Well, speaking of the issue of malaria, were you guys taking the two types of pills, the daily pill and the, was it the monthly or weekly?
We took a huge orange pill on Monday, every Monday, and then we took, I think, a white pill every day.
Okay.
Still didn't work on me, I don't know why.
Right. All right. What, if you don't mind me asking, what type of symptoms were you having to let you know that you had malaria?
Well, and that's the other thing the doctor, I think, thought I was faking, but I'd have fever, but I wouldn't have the chills. I'd just have fever, and then it'd go away, and it'd come back and go away. And they shipped me to the rear. The medic out in the, and I, that's another thing. I'd like to find this guy's name, but we only ever knew him as Doc. but he says, I think you're sick. He said, I think you have malaria. I'm going to ship you back to the rear. So they shipped me back to the rear, and these two doctors looked at me, and they said, well, we think you're okay. Well, that night they were having fried chicken. We never ever got fried chicken in the field, and fried chicken is one of my favorite dishes.
Right.
And they had fried chicken back there, and I ate it, and about an hour later, I threw everything up.
Right.
And that's when the other doctor said, we're going to send you down to, I think it was Chulai or some other place. He said, so they shipped me down there, and of course, that's when I really got sick.
Yeah.
I came home, I weighed 98 pounds.
Wow.
I never weighed 98 pounds in my life.
How long had you been in country when you got sick? You know.
Well, I was just about to go on R&R, so I think it was about my 11th or 12th month.
Mm.
I extended. I hated the Army so much. I extended in Vietnam a little less than 2 months because at that time, if you came home and you had less than 6 months, you got an automatic early out.
Mm.
So I extended. I told the guy I wanted to extend, and my buddy Hoy says, "You're crazy. You're going to get killed. You're crazy." And anyway, I spent the last like month and a half in hospitals in Vietnam and Japan, so it worked out. Somebody up there liked me.
But you did not get an R&R though, correct?
Never got an R&R. No.
All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about I guess the experience of going through the medical system there in Vietnam and Japan, what that was like for you?
With the exception of that one doctor, I thought most of the medical people were very, very caring people. The nurses, when I was so sick, the nurses would take care of me. And do you know what a hare lip is?
No, sir.
It's a person that's got like a cleft.
Okay.
Cleft palate. They called them hare lips when we were kids.
Okay.
This nurse, Army nurse, had a cleft palate, I guess, hair lip.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so good to me. And after I kind of got through it, and they got me well enough so I could be, like, walking wounded, that's when they shipped me to Japan.
Okay.
But anyway, in talking to her, you never ask anybody where you're from, you know, because nobody knows where South Sioux City, Nebraska is. So I usually say, well, I'm from the Midwest or anything. Well, I was talking to this nurse, and she said, well, I'm from Nebraska. And I said, really? I said, I am too. Where are you from? And she said, Norfolk, which is about 60 miles from my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm from South Sioux City, Nebraska. And she said, you couldn't believe it that you'd come all the way over there, you know, and run into people like that. But I thought the medical staff in Vietnam was top-notch. I thought the medical people in Japan were even better. They shipped me to a place called Higashi Kanagawa, and it was the first train stop north of Yokohama.
Okay.
And I was there for, I don't know, at least 3 weeks or something. I'd never been in an earthquake before.
Mm-hmm.
And this place had a pool, so in the afternoons we'd go out and sit in the pool, and I was sitting at this this lawn chair, or, you know, a lawn sofa, and I thought my buddy was kicking my lawn sofa, and I said, what are you doing? And he said, nothing. And we looked at the water in the pool, and the pool was just lapping, and that we were in an earthquake. And so that happened, and then they ended up sending me to a place called Camp Sama, C-A-M-A.
Okay.
And it's an army installation that was originally Japan's West Point. And all the buildings are the same as they were before. And I was there probably 2 weeks, something like that. And they made me pull details, and then they ultimately shipped me home from there.
All right. How were you treated for the malaria?
They give you, I think it's quinine, I think it is.
Okay.
And that's about the only thing they can do for you.
Okay.
And it's your body. But I don't know if you know or are familiar with malaria, but what it does, it kills all your white blood cells.
Okay.
Your blood cells eat or to fight. So what happens, you can't die the moment.
Hello? Hello? Did I lose you? Hello?
You there? Aaron?
It's breaking up a little bit.
Okay. Hey, can I do this? Are you going to be on the phone and call you right back?
This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with retired Senior Master Sergeant Larry Brooks. Today is October 15th, 2010, and this is interview session number two. Okay, you mentioned just a moment ago that there were a few things that you wanted to cover that we...
Yeah, I apologize again. It's been a long time, and there's a couple fire bases. When we were talking yesterday, I believe my first fire base was Eagle's Nest.
Okay.
And Eagle's Nest, I've got locations. Eagle's Nest was on the eastern edge of the Oshawa Valley, northward, approximately 35 kilometers west-southwest of Hue.
Okay.
From there, I had told you yesterday we moved to Tomahawk. That is incorrect. When we came off... the main base, we made a stop at a place called Fire Support Base Vagel, V-E-G-H-A-L, I believe. Vagel was the artillery battalion's headquarters.
Okay.
And we just stopped there for a day or two. They brought the guns to us, but we didn't fire them or set them up or anything else. It was just enough to get us off the mountain.
All right.
From there, we went to a beach area, and I call it Fire Support Base Beach, and it was an ex-Marine artillery emplacement, and we went there for, I want to say, maybe 2 weeks, and then we ended up at Tomahawk. Yesterday, I kind of skipped those two
right.
As far as going. And you asked me about Tomahawk. Tomahawk was along QL1 near the north end of the High Van Pass, and 40 kilometers south of Hue, along the South China Sea.
All right.
And then the other location was Los Banos. That was where we went to next. And that was 34 kilometers north-northwest of Da Nang.
Okay.
So I just want to kind of clear that up.
Sure.
Let's see. There were a couple other things. I can't think of them right now. I did want to tell you one story of when we were on... I believe it was Eagle's Nest. It was the first location we were at.
Okay.
When we were digging out the mountain and filling sandbags and making our bunkers and everything, I tell the story, and most people don't believe me, but we found earthworms that were up to 3 foot long, 2.5 feet, 3 foot long,
wow.
And were about 1.5 to 2 inches in diameter. I thought they were snakes at first, but they were actually earthworms. That's how remote this place was. So I wanted
right.
to tell you about that. I don't know if anybody's ever mentioned that.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, anything else before we continue?
Let me check my notes just a second. I tried to write everything down that I was going to talk to you about.
Okay.
Let's see. And, of course, I can't find my notes now. So. I also have a listing of all the men that were killed in my unit.
Okay.
Over the entire war. I didn't know if you needed that, or I can send that to you. Also, you asked me if some other people in my unit had made an impression on me.
Right.
And I have a card file. I'm trying to get in touch with, not get in touch, but try to keep a card file on everybody that served in Vietnam and with the A battery. Can you hold on just a second? I need to.
Sure.
I'd like to mention a couple names to you.
Okay.
First of all, there's a gentleman by the name of Mickey Adams, who is one of the gentlemen on our gun. And also, there was a Richard D. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, and he was the battalion commander while I was over there. I met him, I think, maybe once or twice, and not real often. Let's see. There was a guy on the guns by the name of David Brinkman, and I have lost contact. Most of these gentlemen I have not had any contact with. There was a gentleman that was on the guns with me, kind of one of my first friends in Vietnam, was a guy by the name of, and I apologize, I don't have his first name. His last name was Brzezinski,
okay.
And he was from Cincinnati, Ohio. And let's see. I had two lieutenants that I thought a lot of. I thought they were very, very professional. The first one was a Captain Samuel, the middle initial J, and this Cavillo. I believe it's spelled C-A-L-V-I-L-L-O. And his call sign was Wetback. He was from El Paso, Texas. He was Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very neat guy.
Right.
There was also a gentleman from Florida that I was on the guns with. I befriended. The last name was Carter, C-A-R-T-E-R. And, again, I have had no contact with him. A gentleman that you might want to get in contact with, that was in the unit just about the time I left. He was in there from 67 to 68. His name is David Flood, F-L-O-O-D.
Okay.
His address is P.O. Box 639.
Excellent. Do you want to hold off on that since we're recording so it doesn't...
Sure.
So it's
sure.
Not on the actual recording?
Sure.
Okay.
You
want to just tell me at the end of the interview?
You bet. I'm trying to get down to the... there's also a gentleman by the name of Larry Gabbard, G-A-B-B-A-R-D, who is head of the ammo dump.
Okay.
Trying to find these other two here. The other lieutenant, the captain at the time that was in FDC was Captain Freddie Jones.
Okay.
And his call sign was Tubar. And let's see, I'm trying to think of one more here. One of my commanders at the time I didn't think too much of was a Captain Clinton, C-L-I-N-T-O-N, Stokes, S-T-O-K-E-S. He was actually relieved of his command due to the drug problem.
Okay.
And then another guy that was in FTC that was very impressionable on me was a gentleman by the name of Ted West, W-E-S-T, and I've never had any contact with him. But I just want to give you some names there in case you run across them, you can co-locate them. And then, the best battery officer commander that I had over there was a gentleman by the name of Clarence Buchwald, B-U-C-H-W-A-L-D, and I am in contact with him. I do have his address, too,
okay.
If you'd like that later on.
All right. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Yesterday, the day before yesterday, when we left off, you were talking about malaria and what it actually does to a person whenever
uh-huh.
the phone started cutting out. I guess if we could pick up there again.
Sure. What malaria does to your body, it kills all your white blood cells. Well, your white blood cells is what fights infection, whether you have a cold or pneumonia. So if during, when you have, malaria never leaves your body, but when it's really bad, it can kill, it doesn't necessarily kill you, but another thing can kill you. Like, rather than getting a cold, you'd get, pneumonia. So, that's how works on your body anyway. So, but I was very lucky to get over that in I would guess a relatively short period of time. I'm talking maybe 3 weeks, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, And the other thing you were talking about, being at Camp, I guess it was Camp Zama, is that correct?
Yes, in Japan, yes.
Right. How long were you there?
I'm guessing I was there probably, 2 weeks, maybe less, maybe a week and a half.
Okay.
When I was sick, I kind of lose track of time. You know, you're in the hospital and you just, every day is the same.
Right.
Kind of runs together.
Right. All right. And that was the last place you were before you actually went home?
That is correct.
Okay. And how did you get home? Was it a civilian transport or military?
You know, I'm trying to think. I think we came home military air, I believe.
Okay.
I think it was a 141. It wasn't a C-130. It wasn't a prop job. It was a jet. But it seems to me it was like a 141.
Okay. All right. And did you come back at Travis?
Yes, we flew into Travis. I was in Japan and flew to Travis. And from Travis, they bussed us down to the Oakland Armory Terminal. And kind of a funny story.
Okay.
When we got into Travis, we had already been issued uniforms and everything else like that. The gentlemen that came back from Vietnam were still in their jungle fatigues. And they had to be processed through and, you know, issued new uniforms, and they had done that to us in Japan.
Okay.
They gave us kind of the night off. The guy says, he told us to be back at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning and we'd be ready for processing.
Right.
The other thing they did for us that I remember very distinctly was when we got to the Oakland Army Terminal, one of the first things they do is they fed us a steak. And they had a little area there where you could go up and get a steak and they'd cook it however you wanted, and which I thought was kind of a nice thing coming back from Vietnam anyway. Anyway, that evening, we did not know what to do. You know, first time back in the United States.
Right.
We ended up in Oakland at the Oakland Raiders bar and proceeded to get fairly stewed.
Right.
And so we partied all night with these girls, and then the next morning we gave them cab fare to get home,
mm-hmm.
and we got back to the Oakland Army Terminal at about 7:45, 7:45, 7:45, something like that.
Okay.
And we got in, and there was this E-5 just running around with his head cut off, and he finally figured out who we were, and he said, "Where have you guys been? You're AWOL and everything else." And we looked at him like, you know, you're crazy.
Right.
And he said, "We've been looking for you since 6 o'clock in the morning to out-process you." And I looked at him, and I said, "You know, a sergeant told us to be back here at 8 o'clock. We're ahead of time. Just cool your heels."
Right.
And of course, I thought it was funny at the time, but, you know, I don't know if we could have gotten in any trouble or not.
Right.
That's kind of my story with that in it.
All right. Well, did you, coming back there and spend a little bit of time there in Oakland, did you run into any of the anti-war protests, anti-soldier type thing? Did you see any of that?
You know, no, we didn't. I didn't. And, again, we processed through the Oakland Army Terminal that morning, and they released us, and I don't think I had a flight till the next day.
Okay.
So another buddy that was in our group, him and I went and got a motel room, and we stayed the night in, I think, Oakland again. We may have stayed by the San Francisco airport out by there, but I just remember getting a room that evening and not really doing anything, but I didn't see any protesters or anything like that at all.
Okay. All right. Well, where'd you go from there?
From there, I boarded an airplane the next morning and flew into Denver. And I remember having kind of a large layover in Denver for some reason. I don't know whatever it was. But then I flew from Denver to Sioux City, Iowa, and it was late in the evening. It was dark, I remember. And got into Sioux City and met my parents and my friend, my closest friend from high school, and they actually drove me home from the airport then in Sioux City.
All right. How did you feel about being home again? Did you have any trouble as adjusting to life outside of Vietnam, life, you know, back to civilian-type life again?
I guess I adjusted fairly good. I mean, when you come from a, you know, I had been in Japan for probably 3 weeks, so it wasn't like I was coming right out of a combat situation, you know, going to a processing station and then going home. I had a little time flexibility in there on time, and I think that helped me somewhat. It gave me a chance to kind of wind down, I guess, a little bit better than maybe some of the individuals. I still had problems. I mean, I slept with a shotgun under my bed for the longest time, and my dad was finally scared. He thought maybe I'd get up in the night and shoot myself or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, he took the shotgun away. But I had to have a weapon. I remember that. I had to have a weapon next to me for a long, long time. I'm talking maybe a month or so.
Okay.
It's winding down from that combat situation where you're under that stress all the time. And again, I had sleeping problems from day one.
Were you finished with the Army at that point? Completely done?
Yes. When you came back from Vietnam and you had less than 6 months, they gave you an automatic early out.
Okay.
And they transferred me at that time to the inactive reserve. I think I was stationed, in St. Louis as a, I guess what you want to call a paper soldier. I was on the books, but I wasn't. You know.
Did you, once you came home, did you continue to follow the war through the media?
Pretty much so. I think even up until the end, what was going on. And I didn't have any written contacts with anybody other than my one buddy from Illinois.
Okay.
And so I didn't have, you know, it was just like you were in the Army one day and you were out the next. You know, there was just a complete break there. And I figured over the years that's probably not the best way to do it. I wish I had stayed in contact with more people. But most Vietnam veterans that I have talked to, they did the same as I. They did the contacts and camaraderie ship that you established when you left Vietnam, it just ended.
Right. All right. As you were back home and following through the media, what did you think of, of the way the war was going the beginnings of Vietnamization, the beginning of Americans pulling out of Vietnam? What did you think of that?
Well, I thought the Vietnamization was a good idea.
Okay.
Those people needed to fight for their country. If they wanted liberty, they needed to fight for it themselves. And I guess that's the thing that one of the other things that kind of upset me is you would see pictures on TV of these young men in Saigon or whatever town it was. Well, why aren't they in uniform? What keeps them out of the military? Yet I, as an American, have to go fight for their freedom. That didn't set very well with me. I always got the impression that the Vietnamese really didn't care. It was more about Americans bringing their money over there.
All right. What did you think of the media's coverage of the war?
I thought the media's coverage was fairly good. From an information standpoint. I'm not a big fan of the gentleman that was fired from CBS, Dan Rather. I don't know if you know any of the story about him, but he flunked out of boot camp. He couldn't even make it through the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a lot of prejudicial judgment on the military from announcers. It was so much different than World War II, where the media was behind the war and, you know, they reported not only good things, but, you know, they reported bad things too, but there was always a slant on it that it was positive for the military. And I always got the impression that the media during the Vietnam War was not that way.
All right. Okay. Well, once you were back home, and what did you do at that point? Once you were out of the military, did you start looking for a job or school, or what did you do after that?
I drank a lot.
Okay.
I drank a lot. I did, not at first, I didn't really look for work. I'd saved, of course, almost all my money from Vietnam. I didn't spend any of it. And so I got home, I had purchased a car, and that was another thing. I had purchased a car, a brand new 1970 Camaro. And, of course, the Camaros that year didn't come out till 70 and a half. They actually, they were so far behind on production, they didn't actually come out till July, I think it was, June. And I got so fed up, I was going to go buy another car. And the night I did, they had called from my Chevrolet dealership that I bought it and said, oh, by the way, your car's in. So I had purchased another older car in between. And so I didn't have, you know, I didn't really have payments. I was living at home. So I drank a lot at night, I guess to relieve the tension. There was just still something brooding inside of me. I didn't know. My dad could see it, but I couldn't see it myself.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, how long did that period last?
Good question. I would say until I found work, I would say it took probably about, I'm guessing, 9 to 12 months. I ended up getting a job at a tool repair shop. It was a warranty place that did warranty work for Sioux Tool. And basically what I did, I became the parts manager and worked there, and that helped a little bit. And my head boss was a World War II veteran, Army, and we talked quite a bit. That helped, and he was very, I want to say, persistent on me to go back to school. And he was very flexible with my hours, and I went back to college and took a few courses, which ultimately helped me down the road. I don't think it really helped at that time, but it gave me encouragement in the to get a higher degree.
Right. At what point did you decide to get back in the military? Is this a little bit later on? We're getting too far ahead.
This was, let's see, I got home in 70.
Okay.
And this would have been, trying to think my dates. I want to guess like 74 or 75.
Okay.
And a buddy of mine that I had run around with before in high school had been in the Air National Guard unit in Sioux City. Everybody calls it the 185th. That's their number, 185th Fighter Group.
Okay.
Anyway, he had been in the 185th when they got activated for Vietnam, and he got sent to Vietnam. As a aircraft, he worked in aircraft maintenance, and he had gotten out once they got home. Well, he came to me and he said, I was working two jobs at the time. I was working at a furniture store, and then I think I was still working at the tool repair place. And he said, well, let's go down and join the guard. And I had hair down to my shoulders. And I said, what would they want me for? He said, well, he said, they're hurting for people. He said, they're looking for prior service people, and they've got a program called Try One. He said, you can join for 1 year. He said, if you don't like it, you can quit. And he said, it's only for a year. And he said, I'm thinking about getting back in. Would you join with me under the buddy program?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, you know, I'll take a look at it. There was something about not being in uniform. I can't tell you what it is, but it was something about wearing that uniform. Again, my father installed a lot of patriotism in me, and I think maybe that had something to do with it. But But anyway, so we went down, and he was talking to one recruiter, and I was talking to the other recruiter. And he asked me what I did, and I said, well, I made, you know, I worked in artillery, which I know you don't have. But I also worked in what we call FDC, and it was an operations area. And I said, I made maps. I said, they always got a kick. Oh, he says, I know what we could put you into. So they tested me, and my scores were very high. I could get into anything. And so that this was during the week. And then on the weekend, I went down and interviewed with the colonel that was head of the section. And what it was Air Force Intelligence. And what they do is they make maps for the pilots that fly the missions. In other words, when they were flying F-100s at that time, fighters. And what they were doing is when they'd fly the mission, they'd have a map that was attached to their leg, usually on the right side. It was kind of a flip map that how they fly the mission. This is where you're going to go bomb, and this is what the mission, so they wouldn't get lost. Well, anyway, I was very good at that, and the colonel was very impressed with me, and he said, sure, we'd like to have you. He says, by the way, you know you have to cut your hair, don't you? And I said, yeah, I know. I said, I don't mind cutting it, you know, as far as that goes. So at this time, I also became a motion picture projectionist, and I was basically working nights. Especially in the summertime when we had the drive-ins open, I would work every night of the week during the summertime. When the drive-ins shut down, then I'd go back to maybe two or three times a night, two or three times each week, a night shift. So I joined the Air National Guard, and it was a completely different exposure than what I'd had in the Army. And it was almost the exact opposite. In fact, one weekend, the colonel got up and started washing windows. Oh, you'd never see that in the Army. And I asked him, I says, I can do that, colonel. I said, no, he says, I want to keep busy. He says, I don't want to be bored. So I let him wash the windows, which, you know, you'd never, ever see anything like that in the Army. So it was a different bunch of officers. It was a different attitude toward people. The NCOs were top-notch. In fact, in my career, I probably only ran into, you know, serving 28 years, I probably only ran into about 10 NCOs that weren't worth the darn. The rest of them, you know, a very, very small percentage of people that were out for themselves rather than out and then taking care of their people. So the other NCO seemed to get on a NCO that wouldn't take care of his people. I mean, it was... I'm not saying it was brutal, but they let them know that, hey, you take care of your people, that type of thing.
Right. Yes,
so I joined for a year, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed who I worked for. I enjoyed doing the work. And the recruiter that recruited me came to me after a year, and he says, I need to ask you a question. He said, would you be interested in becoming a recruiter? Well, as a projectionist, I had gotten high up in the union, and actually I was state secretary of the projectionist union for the state, and I said, well, you know, I said, I work nights. I said, I can't, you know. He says, well, if something happens, let me know. Well, we ended up going on strike, and it was a lockout, and so my boss in the intel section was giving me what they call mandates, extra days that they had to come down and work on projects. Well, the recruiter came over and he said, I understand you lost your job at this projectionist. He said, do you think you're ever going to get it back? And I said, well, probably not. I said, we don't have any hope that it would, but I said, you never know. He said, well, would you like to go to recruiting school? And I said, are you sure? Are you sure you're talking to me? And I had never sold anything in my life, never had any training that way. So I went through training school, came back. And it was during the Jimmy Carter administration, and the Carter administration totally underfunded the military at that time. They were getting funds like every 6 months, so they could only put me on orders for 6 months. I never knew from one day to the next if I had a job or not. It was a very tempestuous time, I guess, in my life. I was married at the time. And anyway, they didn't know where they were going to fund me. They didn't. So I ended up coming back in the office one afternoon, and there were three of us recruiters, myself and two other gentlemen.
Okay.
And the other gentleman, for some reason, had called Lincoln, Nebraska. For my wildest expectations, I never know why he called Lincoln, Nebraska. And they said, well, they needed two of the recruiters were quitting, and he said they needed help right away down there. So I called down there and talked to the gentleman, and he said, well, could you come down for an interview? And I said, well, sure. So I drove down to Lincoln and interviewed, and my initial reaction was, this is even a better unit than the Sioux City unit, which the Sioux City unit was a very good unit. But, and I met the commander, and I'll never forget, I had one of these fake ties on that clip on.
Right.
And I was interviewing with the director of personnel, and the commander of the unit walked in, and I stood up, and that tie fell off. And I says, there is no way I'm getting this job.
Right.
So anyway, so I interviewed, and they said their goodbyes, and they said they'd contact me in a couple of days. Anyway. So I drove back up to Sioux City, and they called that evening, and I said, if you want the job's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I impressed somebody. I don't know who it was. But,
right.
But so anyway, I ended up moving down to Lincoln, Nebraska, and then becoming a production recruiter with them.
Okay.
And then ultimately became office manager, and then when the head recruiter retired, I became the what they call recruiting and retention programs manager for the Guard.
All right. Did you, one thing I meant to ask you a little bit earlier, when you got back in, got into the Air Force, what was your rank when you came in?
They at that time were allowed, usually in the Air Force, you can recruit anybody up to the rank of E5.
Okay.
So my Army rank, I was a Spec 4, so they transferred me over to an Army E4, which is a sergeant at that time.
Okay.
And so I came across as an E4, got promoted to E5 when I was in Intel, and then when I became a recruiter, when I went to Lincoln, they promoted me to E6. So
okay.
That's kind of how that went.
All right. And did you enjoy recruiting?
I did. I mean, it has its ups and downs. Don't get me wrong. It's a very pressure job. Most jobs in the Air Force are not pressure. But it is a pressure job. You have to continue to produce. But in Lincoln was so much different than Sioux City. Recruiting in Sioux City was really tough. I mean, they had no benefits. I'm not saying no benefits, but they had very few benefits. Where when I went to Lincoln, they were offering 75% tuition if a high school senior or anybody else wanted to go back to college. They would pay 75% of their tuition, in addition to just being a part-timer. So it was a very lucrative business, and we got a lot of quality kids that way, because you got kids that wanted to go to college and you know, were probably at least in the top half of their class.
So you mostly recruited at the high schools then? Any on the campus there in Nebraska? Or?
Yes, we recruited the high schools. We recruited the university was very good to us. Again, there was a state organization, and the Air Guard being a state organization, they kind of had a togetherness, or they at least kind of worked with each other. So.
Given the time period, did you run into any hostility whatsoever?
As I remember back, the only hostility I ever ran into is when I was in Sioux City, we were recruiting at Morningside College.
Okay.
And there were some, I don't call them anti-war, but there were some anti-military people there that would give us sarcastic remarks. But most of the people... most of the people in the Midwest are really pro-military, so I never really had any problem except with that one time in Morningside College.
Okay, sir. All right. How long did you do this for, the recruiting?
I recruited for, about 23 years.
Okay, all right. And most of it was done there in Lincoln?
Yes, the majority. I recruited a short time in Sioux City, talking maybe a year,
Okay.
And then the rest of my recruiting was done in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Okay. And did you retire as a recruiter? Or?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay.
I was what the title is Recruiting and Retention of Programs Manager for this, and I worked at the Adjutant General's office.
Okay.
With their headquarters.
What year did you retire?
1998.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else we should cover about that time period before moving on?
I can't think of anything offhand. If any questions come up, just give me a holler.
Okay. All right. Well, what I usually do to wrap the interviews up, I have some broad-based questions about the war, just to get your opinion on some of the larger issues, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Okay. All right. Well, now you've touched on some of these issues a little bit, but, well, first of all, looking back on your experience in Vietnam and the way the war turned out, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam? Do you think we should have been there? Do you think we should not have been there? And how do you feel about your own service?
Boy, that's a very encompassing question, because I've probably gone back and forth on that issue a number of times. A lot of times I think what we were trying to do there, I think, was good. What we actually, in fact, did there, I don't think was very good. I got the feeling that the officers used it basically as a stepping stone. In other words, the longer the war went on, the more officers promoted. You know, it was that type of thing. I thought what we were trying to do in Southeast Asia of starving off communism, I think was good. I just don't think the way we went about it was the correct way. We tried to fight a World War II war against counterinsurgency, and we could have done that better. So from that aspect, I have mixed feelings. I thought we should have been there. I don't think it was worth the loss of life that the young men from the United States that died for something that today is held in communism. It just wasn't meant to be, I guess. Does that answer most of the question? Or you had to get something at the end of that question?
No, and the other thing was, and how do you feel about your own service?
Well, I guess I would have to say I wish I had tried harder. I wish I'd have given more, but again, I look at it as I was a draftee that was forced into it, and so I had an attitude, and I'm not saying that I never tried to fire missions correctly or when I was on the guns to fire the guns properly. It's just that I had, at the beginning, a lackadaisical attitude because I was drafted. Had I enlisted, I think it would have been a completely different story. So I'm not totally proud. I'm proud of what I did. I'm not proud of the fact that I could have done more. Is that comprehensive?
All right. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, that brought up a question that I meant to ask you last time. Did you notice any tension between draftees versus those who enlisted? Were you treated any differently because you were drafted?
That's an interesting question that I posed to a former commander of the 320th,
okay,
of A Battery, and he said that he couldn't tell the difference between a draftee and a regular soldier, RA.
All right.
Now, when I looked at it from my attitude, usually if they were going to promote somebody, they would promote a person that was RA rather than U.S.
Okay.
I got that impression, and I believe that to be a truth. I just think they got promoted faster, which, again, you know, they were in for another year than what we were.
Right.
My question is, who do you promote? Do you promote lifers and those type of people, or do you promote the people that are doing the best job?
Right.
And that seemingly to me is the question. And I take it the Army, in most cases, promoted the guy that was going to stay in.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Excuse me. Another question I want to ask you was, what was your reaction to the fall of Saigon and the way the war ended?
Well, I watched it in my home in Sioux City on TV, and I became very emotional. It was like all we did over there wasn't worth a darn. And I realized they had to get out of there. I mean, you know, the war had gone on for years and years and years, but it was so disheartening to watch those helicopters fly out to those aircraft carriers and then push them overboard. It was very disheartening. Very emotional time in my life.
How do you feel about U.S. policy towards Vietnam today in this developing relationship that we have with Vietnam, with trade and tourism?
Well, my personal opinion is we shouldn't. You know, my opinion doesn't mean anything. My personal opinion is that we shouldn't deal with those people till they get rid of communism. That's my personal point. I don't think anybody. You know, that is under the strains of communism or so-called socialism, we should do anything for. I don't think we should send them any aid or anything. That's my personal opinion.
Okay. All right. So how about the side of it of veterans going back over there to see their old battlefields and things? What do you think about that? And would you ever have any interest in doing so yourself?
I have mixed feelings about it. In a way, I don't think they should do it, but I think it may help some of them reestablish themselves. Would I go? I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not saying I wouldn't go, but I'm not saying I would go either. Boy, that's a tough question for me. There's so many other places I want to visit before I go back there.
Have you been to see the Vietnam Wall? And if so, what did you think of it?
Yes. The first time I really got drunk, I got drugged bad. And it was such an emotional event for me. When I went the first time, the statue had not been built.
Okay.
And so it was, I think it was the second anniversary of the wall, I think. And it's a very moving thing. I've been back a number of times, and I've always tried to etch the guys from my hometown that were killed, that their names are on the wall. And it's very emotional for me. It's a very sacred place. And when they put the statue up, I thought that was even better. I know Mai Ling, the lady who designed the wall, was not too happy with it, but I think she's got to look at it from our perspective. And I think the place stays very hallowed ground.
Yes, sir. Is there anything else you'd like to say, anything else we should cover that we haven't at this point?
There's a couple things that I'd like to talk to you about.
Sure.
On movements, when I was talking to you yesterday, I finally found my notes after I talked to you, of course. But as far as our movements, we talked about when we left Los Banos and went down and supplemented the AmeriCal division.
Right. Yes, sir.
I want to give you a list of the fire bases that we're at, and I couldn't think of their names yesterday, and finally found, after about a day of research, I finally found them, but... When we were flown down to, I think I said Chu Lai, and I think that's inaccurate. It's near Chu Lai. But anyway, when we were taken out in the field, our first fire base was a place called Professional, Professional.
Okay.
And I believe that's where the... Special Forces base camp was, if I remember right.
Okay.
Then the next three bases, I think we built those if I remember right. The first one was a place called Firebase Hustler, H-U-S-T-L-E-R. The next base was Young, Y-O-U-N-G. And the last place was Boxer, B-O-X-E-R.
Okay.
And that's where I believe I contracted malaria. And those were all three of their base. In other words, we came in and we built the base up. There was nothing there before us.
Right, yes, sir.
And, again, that was mid to late 1969. And let's see, go back through my notes here just real quickly.
Sure.
I can't think of anything else offhand. Oh, let's see. No, I can't. I can't. Nothing else right now. I'll probably think of something after I hang up.
All right. Well, if there's nothing else, then I will go ahead and bring the interview to a close. Stop the